This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When I heard the news that Osama bin Laden was killed by U.S. forces in Pakistan, I had a lot of questions. And one of the people I wanted to talk to was Lawrence Wright. He's joined us several times on the show. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his 2006 book, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11, which is based in part on more than 500 interviews, including interviews with friends and relatives of bin Laden. After the book's publication, Wright continued to investigate the story of Al-Qaeda. His film, My Trip to Al-Qaeda, was shown on HBO last year. We called him late this morning. Lawrence Wright, thank you for joining us. You've devoted years of your life researching bin Laden, tracking down people who knew him. What was your first reaction when you heard that he was killed?
Well, honestly, Terry, there was a tremendous sense of relief. This seemed like something that was so long in coming. And with all the changes that have been going on in the Arab world right now, real change in some ways couldn't come until this moment happened.
Why? I mean, do you see this as having more symbolic difference or real, genuine leadership difference?
Oh, I think it makes a profound change, in part because bin Laden and bin Ladenism stood in the way of the kind of reforms that are really needed to take the Arab world to the place where it really wants to be. The reaction that Al-Qaeda was to the kind of ingrained autocratic rule in that part of the world was one approach. It was a failure, but it still had a residual constituency, and I imagine will continue to have, but it'd be much diminished by the death of bin Laden.
But does Al-Qaeda really end or get much diminished without bin Laden? There's still a leadership change. I imagine he was pretty physically disabled toward the end of his life.
Listen, bin Laden is, you know, he's not irrelevant. He was important all along. Just the fact that he was able to elude capture or being killed for nearly a decade, actually more than a decade, if you go back to the embassy bombings in 1998 when we first went after him, he's been a symbol of resistance and also the failure of American policy to reach out and stop this kind of terror. It emboldened other imitators all around the globe. So getting bin Laden is immeasurably important.
How did the reality of his demise compare with some of the scenarios you'd imagined?
Actually, Terry, I think it was in 2006 the CIA came to me to write a scenario, in their words, about what would we do if we got bin Laden, because this has been a subject of concern within the intelligence community. What if we did get him? How would we treat him? Where would we take him? Would it be better to take him alive or dead? And because I had written this movie, The Siege, you know, and Hollywood had done a somewhat better job of connecting the dots about terrorism and the threat to America than the intelligence community, the CIA was reaching out to screenwriters, such as I had done. And I said, well, you know, I'm a reporter. I can't go writing screenplays for the CIA, but I'll tell you in the form of an op-ed for the New York Times what I think if we were able to catch bin Laden. First of all, remember that bin Laden is the most famous man in the world. He's going to be one of the most famous men in history. So if you have the good luck to catch him, you have to deal with the legacy, not just the man. And if you catch him, don't kill him, because he'll become a martyr, which is what he seeks to be. But don't take him to America just yet. First of all, take him to Kenya, where on August 6, 1998, he set off a bomb in front of an American embassy, killing 224 people and wounding, blinding 150 Africans. Let him sit in a courtroom in Nairobi and tell 150 blind Africans that he was just striking at a symbol of American power. And then you could take him to Tanzania, where on the same day he set off another bomb in front of another American embassy, killing 11 people, all of them Muslims. And bin Laden excused that because it was Friday and good Muslims would be in the mosque. I think that would be a wonderful venue to talk about what a good Muslim actually is. And then you could bring him to America and have him answer for the death of the 17 sailors on the USS Cole in October 2000 and the 3,000 Americans who died on 9/11. But you don't have to stop there. You could take him so many places, you know, Casablanca, Madrid, London, Bali. But just take him one last place. Take him home and try him under Sharia law, which is the only law that he and his followers would respect. And if he's convicted, he would be taken to a square in downtown Riyadh. And the executioner is a big man with a long sword. And it's Saudi custom for the executioner to go out and ask the crowd, which is composed of the victims of the condemned man, to forgive him. And if they couldn't do that, then the executioner would do his job and bin Laden would be taken and buried in an unmarked Wahhabi graveyard. And I thought in that manner, you could begin to roll back some of his awful legacy.
Wow, but of course he's gone now, so that scenario is never going to happen. What was the CIA reaction to that scenario?
Well, they appreciated that I had attempted to write a response to it, but their main concern was if we captured him, Americans would be kidnapped and held in ransom. And that is a lively scenario, and I suspect that there was not very much of an interest in capturing bin Laden. Leon Panetta, the director of the CIA, said that if we did capture him, we would put him at Guantanamo, which I think would have been a miserable solution.
But now that American forces have killed him, what are the odds that he's going to become a martyr and continue to live as this potent symbol?
He will continue to live as a potent symbol. There's no question that he's going to have an enduring appeal for a number of people, not just perhaps radical Muslims, but other groups that will follow the template that al-Qaeda created. That's my main concern. Bin Laden is dead. Al-Qaeda eventually will die. But the model that al-Qaeda has created of an asymmetric terror group that has enormous consequences in the world well beyond the size of the group, that's going to endure. Other groups are going to try to follow that model.
You talked about some of the positive outcomes that you see in the in the killing of bin Laden. Are there bad ripple effects you're expecting?
I do expect that the plans that may be in the pipeline will be rushed into operation as soon as possible on the part of al-Qaeda or its affiliates or its wannabes. Just last week, we had the bombing in Marrakesh and the arrests in Germany, both of which seem to be tied to al-Qaeda or affiliates. And so it shows that, you know, al-Qaeda continues to be an active operation with entrepreneurial followers who are looking for an opportunity to create more damage.
How surprised were you that bin Laden was actually hiding out, at least recently, in a compound in a neighborhood about an hour's drive from Islamabad, the capital city of Pakistan, near a Pakistani military base and military academy? He was not in a remote cave.
Well, I was surprised, I would have to say, you know, that he was living inside an urban area. But I'm not surprised to learn that he was essentially sheltered by Pakistani intelligence and military units.
Is that the assumption you're making, that they were
complicit?
I
do make that assumption. Uh-huh. I feel that, that for years the Pakistani military and intelligence complex has been in the looking for bin Laden business. He was a priceless asset to them because we poured billions of dollars into their pockets to try to find him. If they found him, they'd be out of business. So he was an irreplaceable asset. And Pakistan has a lot to answer for. This looks very incriminating. And I think it reflects on our relationship with that country, and this gives us an opportunity to reassess exactly what our relationship with Pakistan ought to be.
A lot of people are troubled about the continuation of the war in Afghanistan. Can you envision a scenario where President Obama basically says, we've got bin Laden, now we can declare victory and wind down that war?
I think that that's a possible scenario. I mean, the Taliban was not really our enemy. It has become so. The Times Square attempted bomber was sent by the Taliban, for instance. That's the first time that's happened. But by its nature, Taliban is essentially a nationalist group. And Al-Qaeda is an internationalist jihad with a primary focus on the United States. We don't need to make the Taliban our principal enemy. And it was because of its alliance with Al-Qaeda that we turned our attention to the Taliban in the first place. If we feel that Al-Qaeda is a much diminished threat, as it may be, we'll see, then our interest in fighting the Taliban could be commensurately diminished as well.
So, Lawrence Wright, thank you so much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure as always, Terry.
Lawrence Wright is the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. Our interview was recorded this morning. Coming up, an interview with Jake Bernstein and Jesse Eisinger. They just won a Pulitzer Prize for national reporting for their stories about how several Wall Street firms and one hedge fund contributed to the financial collapse. This is Fresh Air.
Americans have spent much of the spring fighting the elements. The last few weeks brought tornadoes, wildfires, and floods. The idea of Americans struggling against nature has preoccupied novelists for generations. In the early 1900s, Willa Cather wrote about overcoming frontier hardship in her novel My Antonia, set on the Nebraska prairie. Author Bradford Morrow recommends the book as part of our series, You Must Read This.
How many of us have been assigned a book to read for a high school English class and come away from the experience thinking, thank God I'll never have to read that again? Willa Cather, one of the truly great American writers of the 20th century, suffers from a somewhat different kind of expulsion from the lives of many adults. In particular, her best-known work, My Antonia, a novel we often first encounter as young adult literature, is a book many of us actually enjoyed in our youth. We feel comfortable leaving it safely, fondly stored in our memory banks, where it remains a humane story about a courageous bohemian immigrant girl forced by fate to grow up on the beautiful, harsh flatlands of Nebraska. We recall characters like the Russian friends Pavel and Peter with haunted clarity. What's interesting about My Antonia are the ways it manages to function as a perfectly inviting story for young readers, but how an adult willing to revisit it with a more developed critical eye can appreciate it for the subtly sophisticated narrative it truly is. Cather is our quietest modernist. She was innovative in her approach to her work. The story is told in the male-gendered voice of Jim Burden, a decision, by the way, that Cather found herself having to defend. Through Burden, Cather uses landscape not merely as backdrop, but as a kind of character, dynamically interactive with Antonia's family, as well as everyone else in Black Hawk, the prairie town based on Red Cloud, Nebraska, where Cather grew up. Pavel's deathbed scene, for instance, is remarkable for its Greek chorus of ghostly winds that impatiently shake the doors and windows of the house. Recently, I visited Red Cloud, not just to see the place where Cather grew up, but where my own mother was born and my grandparents, great-grandparents, and great-great-grandparents lived. And I found that even today, the fields, farms, and small-town streets remain somehow captured in Willa Cather's fiction. There are certain books I try to reread every 5 years or so. Not because the novels have changed, but because I have. My Antonia reflects not just a particular period of time in America's adolescence, but if you happen to relish it when you were young, experiencing it again from a more seasoned perspective might shed light on your own journey and bring into focus the Antonias and Jim Burdens who've influenced you along the way. And if you haven't read this classic, I envy you your first journey through the novel Cather herself considered her finest achievement.
Bradford Morrow is the author of The Diviner's Tale. If you want to discuss this and other books with NPR listeners, you can join the NPR Facebook community by searching for NPR Books and clicking Like.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is special coverage of the death of Osama bin Laden. Bin Laden was the mastermind, of course, behind the worst ever terrorist attack on U.S. soil. He was killed by U.S. forces yesterday morning, Pakistan time. For some analysis, we're joined now by counterterrorism expert David Kilcullen of the Center for a New American Security. Good morning.
Hi, Renee. How are you?
Pretty good. Thank you very much. Now, it took nearly 10 years to find bin Laden. What does his death mean for the future of al-Qaeda, that terrorist network that he founded and led and was a symbol of?
Well, I think in the short term, it probably doesn't mean the collapse of the network. In fact, I think we may see a little bit of a surge of retaliatory violence, perhaps worldwide, but certainly in Pakistan and Afghanistan in the short term. But over the long term, I think it's going to inevitably lead to a drop in the credibility and support for al-Qaeda. He was such an important inspirational and motivational figure that I think this does make a significant long-term difference.
You know, we've been getting reactions from around the world on this, and one of those applauding the death of bin Laden is Afghanistan President Hamid Karzai, and he's saying this morning that the strike in Pakistan proves the real fight against terrorists is outside Afghanistan's borders. What do you say to that?
Well, I
because
think
it was Pakistan.
One of the most
obviously.
Important things we need to consider here is the likely outcome in terms of peace in Afghanistan. And I think that's one of the most important potential upsides here. One of the issues for the Taliban has been that it's been very difficult for them to engage in serious negotiations for a peace settlement while Osama bin Laden remains alive and Mullah Omar, the leader of the Taliban, remained committed to him. I think this changes their calculus, but it will take a while for that to play out.
Of course, Mullah Omar, the leader, or the original leader of the Taliban, is alive, as far as anyone knows, and not clear where he is. But a lot of thinking is that he's in Pakistan. Is what President Karzai said, is there some truth to that, that it really terrorism is outside its borders?
I think that Pakistan has very much been the center of gravity for a lot of terrorism, both in the region and, in fact, worldwide over the past decade. So I think, in that sense, President Karzai is correct. I would just add that there's still a very significant fight going on inside Afghanistan and a lot of civilian casualties, a lot of damage to the population. The job isn't done in Afghanistan. And I think the most important job is making peace at this point.
Just briefly, will the demise of Osama bin Laden affect American counterterrorism strategy from here on out?
Very much so. I wouldn't want to speculate on how, but I think that this will most definitely change the dynamic. One of the things that we can expect is that al-Qaeda may turn inward briefly while they figure out some of the succession issues associated with this. And for them, you know, this has been their worst year ever. The Middle East and North Africa democracy spring that we've seen in the past few months is causing their major grievance, which has been driving their support, to evaporate. And it's certainly not helped by the loss of Osama bin Laden. So I think they've got some serious problems right now.
Thank you very much, counterterrorism expert David Kilcullen. He's the author of The Accidental Guerrilla Fighting Small Wars in the Midst of a Big One. This is special coverage from NPR News.